Okay, with our next presentation, this is session code 061, the challenges of parenteral nutrition when a patient is immunocompromised. Diana Duke is a certified nutrition support dietitian at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, where she is a member of the nutritional support team, primarily responsible for the GI surgical service. Currently, she is the president of the Texas Gulf Coast Society of Parenteral and Enteral Nutrition and has been on the board for the last 4 years. In addition, she is currently pursuing her PhD in clinical nutrition at the Texas Women's University. Please join me in welcoming Diana Duke.
Hello, good morning. I'm Diana, and I'm glad to see a lot of faces out there in the audience. I wasn't sure how many people would be that interested in immunonutrition. I want to start just by giving a basic information about the immune system. You all already know about the immune system, but I felt like I needed to define at least part of this that was in relationship to nutrition and into the talk. To begin with, the immune system actually includes all structures and processes that provide defense against potential pathogens. We find it mainly localized in the gut or the vicinity of the gut, which allows for the greatest potential to affect and enhance disease resistance through the immunonutrition modulation. Disease resistance is best modulated during the acute phase response in the inflammatory cascade, and a key component to immunonutrition is initiating it early on in the phase, because the goal of bringing in these immunonutrients is to stop the inflammatory response. And so, you know, everything happens quite quickly when you have a trauma or another type of injury, whether it be surgery. And within the first 5 to 10 days is when we're really going to use these nutrients and find the most benefit with the patient. The GI tract during stress becomes a cytokine-generating organ. This is where everything is perpetuated. We have all these responses occurring, and many diets have been developed to help control this process. Although we have a lot of disappointing data, most of the information that we have is based with animal models. And with the animal models, we understand the mechanisms in which immunonutrition works, but we're still incorporating the clinical data to really understand the amount, the time frame, you know, and the composition of the nutrients for different types of patients, whether it be a septic patient, a trauma patient, a surgical patient. So what is an immunocompromised patient? I want to define this for y'all so you have an idea of what population I'm looking at. Well, there's a couple of different types of immunocompromised patients that we can be looking at. Immunocompromised patient is a state in which the patient's immune system's ability to fight infectious disease is compromised or entirely absent. There can be a congenital or primary immune deficiency, something that a person's born with, which we know early on in life most of the time. Or it can be an acquired immune deficiency, something that's induced, such as with chemotherapy, something we're trying to block the immune system from its normal process in order to treat a disease. Or it could be an HIV patient, somebody who has acquired their disease later on in life. So there's a couple of different population groups we can have that's immunocompromised. Another group that we don't normally think of when we think of immunocompromised patients are the malnourished patient. And any time a patient is malnourished, they aren't getting the nutrients that they would normally have to support their immune system. And so this population actually expands. So if you have somebody who for any reason can't take in nutrients, they're also considered an immunocompromised patient. What happens with the immunocompromised patient metabolically? The reason why this is so important is because we need to understand what's happening to these individual patients so we know how to appropriately tend to what their needs are. I've just broken it down into the starved patient and then a patient who has an injury. And the reason why I broke it into these two groups is because they're very different. A cachexic patient or a cancer patient, for example, I work at a cancer institute, so I tend to focus on cancer when I think of a starved patient, but it could be any patient who has some reason why they haven't eaten. Metabolically, they're reacting differently. When a patient's been starved or has been deprived of nutrition or reduced amount of nutrition, their body automatically goes into metabolic alert. They start finding that their bodies require less energy. Their body knows how to conserve, and so their energy needs are actually decreased. A lot of times we think, oh gosh, this patient hasn't eaten. We really need to just beef them up. Eat all that you can. Get all the food that you can and just, you know, get all these calories in. But the thing is, if you measure them with an indirect calorimetry and really see what their needs are, you'd be surprised to find that they're quite lower than what we'd anticipate. So we don't necessarily have to overfeed them initially. There's also some concerns with refeeding syndrome that can happen with patients who have been starved. And this can actually be a life-threatening condition if we overfeed too quickly. There can be a lot of metabolic responses that can be detrimental. With the injured patient, for example, on the other hand, someone who's having surgery or someone who's been in a car accident, their energy needs are very high. Their body's in shock. They're, you know, everything's going 90 miles an hour. Hurry, hurry, hurry. We've got to repair. So there's a totally different mechanism happening with the injured patient. Primary fuel source, starvation. We're looking at lipids. They've already depleted their immediate stores. They've already gone through their glucose stores. They've actually gone through some of their muscle. So now they're using lipids. That's our last reservoir for our fuel. With the injured patient, it's mixed because it's early on. They haven't been starved, so their body's using all different sources for their energy and their fuel. Insulin becomes very important, especially with the critically ill patient. A lot of times in the ICU, we have them on drips. We're monitoring them very closely. Even if they're not diabetic, here they are hyperglycemic. Well, the reason why is because they're actually having a resistance. It's part of our body's process. Whenever we go through this, we don't utilize energy the same way. We aren't in our normal state. With starvation, it's decreased. They don't need the energy that's there as much. They're not in this inflammatory phase that's causing this metabolic chaos. With ketones, we have them present in the starved patient. Anytime you're using fat as an energy source, you're going to notice ketones in the system. Same with a diabetic who doesn't utilize their insulin appropriately. They're absent in the injured patient, again, because we're using a mixed fuel source. We move down and start talking a little bit about proteolysis. One thing I want to mention in protein catabolism, it's decreased in the starved patient because they've already used that source of energy. They're moving on to fat. But with the injured patient, it's actually accelerated. The excess rate in protein catabolism causes a negative nitrogen balance. The loss of muscle mass and protein degradation in vital organs, which means we're pulling protein from all sources. And this is important to know because we do this very quickly, and the ICU patient can lose quite a bit of their muscle mass in a very short amount of time because they're using so much of that for their energy. It's very important to be aware of the length of time somebody is gone without getting some source of nutrition, because it's very, it can be very effective to feed them early on so they don't go through this process. Proteolysis causes the movement of amino acids, alanine and glutamine, from the periphery to the visceral for gluconeogenesis. Okay, we're going to start making our energy fuel, which is glucose. Everything we use for energy is converted to glucose. Protein, fat, that's the only way that our body knows how to use energy is glucose. So it's going to start converting over these energy sources into glucose. Alanine is the amino acid that goes and is used for hepatic gluconeogenesis. And glutamine is the preferred energy source for cells, the immune system, the enterocytes, the cells involved in tissue repair. So a large part of our muscle mass is made up of alanine and glutamine, and that's why we're using that muscle mass. There's always a decrease in visceral protein stores, regardless of the patient's nutritional status. And this is important to say because a lot of times we get hung up on labs and we start looking at the numbers, but do we really understand the cascades that are going on? We see albumin, it's 2.4. Oh my goodness, their protein's low. Well, of course it's going to be low because their liver is not focusing on making albumin. Their liver's focusing on making glucose. So there's a change and a shift in prioritizing. So sometimes it can be a little confusing because we rely so much on our laboratory values to help us guide our care. The next item listed here is glycogenolysis. And with the starved patient, they're constantly, we're breaking things down, we're using that energy source. And with the injured patient, it's accelerated as well. Everything's accelerated, it seems like, with the injured patient because it's a short-term, immediate response. During stress, there's an increase in endogenous glucose production resulting from increased counter-regulatory hormones and cytokines that stimulate glycogenolysis and gliconeogenesis. Alanine is a major source from skeletal muscle used in gliconeogenesis. Others are glycerol from adipose tissue and lactate from peripheral tissue and skeletal muscle. And so just understanding that we're using all energy sources to make glucose is kind of what I want y'all to walk away with. Lipolysis is accelerated with the mobilization of glycerol and fatty acids, and there is an increase in fatty acid oxidation. Overall, the patient's energy stores are reduced. We're utilizing this in both populations. Like I said earlier, the starved patient is using the fat as their major energy source, but then in the injured patient, it's mixed, so they're also using it. We see a reduction in skeletal muscle in the starved patient. If you ever see a cachexic patient, you look at the temporal wasting, you notice how their body is altered because of how they've utilized their energy stores. And in the injured patient, we're also seeing a reduction, like I said earlier, with a patient who's been in ICU and they're using those sources very fast. We're going to see a reduction in their skeletal muscle, their tone. Everything's going to be compromised. Fat stores again. We have a reduced amount of fat stores left with the starved patient. That's why their metabolic rate's lower, even though that's what they're using as their energy source. And with the injured patient as well, we're using that as an energy. Their visceral proteins, now this is interesting and it kind of is confusing too, but with the starved patient, we're preserving it. The body knows it needs protein, so it's going to it's shifting at a certain level, and it's going to start using fat as its energy source. But it knows it needs the protein for certain processes that happen in our system. With the injured patient, you're going to see a higher amount of protein in the blood at times, like if you did a prealbumin and you check that, because it's breaking down protein from the muscle. And a lot of times that value in the blood will be higher. You'll see a sudden drop a lot of times, but initially it may show as a higher number and everything looks okay, and okay, this patient's fine. Then you check 2 days later and it's low, because then that's when the liver's kicked in and it's no longer transferring it over. Then the lean tissue loss, again, is like what I mentioned earlier, how that's accelerated in the injured patient, and they use that as their energy source early on. So the nutrition response. How is the patient responding that's going to affect them nutritionally? What's going on? Well, they're having a decreased caloric intake. That's a big component. Decreased intake of proteins and amino acids, resulting in a protein-calorie malnutrition. And this is what I said earlier. We don't a lot of times think about patients who just aren't eating for whatever reason, but these patients are malnourished patients. You could be obese and be malnourished. You can be your ideal body weight and be malnourished. It's a complex picture of what actually constitutes somebody being malnourished. So don't ever think if you have a patient who, you know, is overweight or carries extra weight on them and you see them as a patient, oh, they have stores, they, you know, they're fine. No, they're not. They're just as much compromised as the patient who's not. So it's important to know that. Trace elements and minerals. These are things that we need to have regular functions in our bodies and cycles that go on. And that's also reduced because it's not available. Vitamins, fat, and antioxidants, all the important components of keeping our body in homeostasis. So what do we do as dietitians? Well, I wanted to do a little bit of this so y'all kind of understand where I'm coming from as a dietitian and how I'm looking at a patient and how to best provide them with this immunonutrition to address the issues that they have. Part of my assessment basically is just in a subjective and objective information, stuff that a lot of healthcare professionals obtain to help them get a better idea of what's going on with the patient. These are just some of the things that we look at to assess how is the best way to feed the patient and what their limitations may or may not be. And, you know, a lot of times laboratory values aren't always the best guide. I put it on there because with most patients who are out of the ICU and you know, pretty stable situation, you can use lab values and address most of the nutritional issues better that way. But in the critical patient, it's a little bit more challenging. But the last thing here is PO versus nutrition support. And I left nutrition support to mean total parenteral nutrition. At MD Anderson, we don't use, we only use total parenteral nutrition. We don't do a lot of PPN. We don't do a lot of PPN at our institution. Our view is that if you need it, then you need it, and we can try supplementing interally if that's the case. But if the gut works, use it. And a lot of times it's not possible to use the gut, but if you can use the gut, that's what we prefer to do. And you'll find later in the talk how much more advantageous the immunonutrition is with a patient who's fed through their gut. So I've assessed the patient. We know they're immunocompromised. We've already looked at what type of patient they are, whether they're a starved patient or an injured patient. So we're understanding metabolically what's happening. We've assessed them to get where they are currently, and now we're going to estimate their, you know, estimate what are we going to feed them. Well, there's a couple of ways we can estimate needs. We can do a measured method, which is really the gold standard. We have a tent. We have a tent. We have handheld at our institution. We also have the indirect calorimetry that we actually hook up to the respirator. So we have a few options. Most institutions that I've worked at prior to this don't have the access to an indirect calorimetry. They're very expensive, and it requires trained personnel in order to operate them. So it's a little bit more cumbersome. But we find that as we do these indirect calorimetry studies with our ICU patients, that we get a better idea of really what's going on metabolically and how to not overfeed them, which I'll mention later on can be actually very dangerous as well. The handheld device, and I have a picture of both of those just to show y'all, is what we use in our ambulatory clinics, especially with our cachexia clinic, which has been actually very helpful in treating those patients. But there's the predicted resting energy expenditure. And this is kind of what most people think of when they think of calculating somebody's needs. We use the empirical method for the most part. The Harris Benedict is fine in conjunction with figuring up this formula. There's also an injury factor and an activity factor that you add on to that. So this is a picture of an indirect calorimetry tent. And the reason why indirect calorimetry is so much more effective in measuring needs is because during the post-insult phase, there's an increase in energy expenditure. And total body oxygen consumption increases because of increased oxidation of fuel sources such as the carbohydrates, amino acids, and fats to provide energy. These reactions produce heat, and the increased heat production indicates an increased metabolic rate. And so that's how we're measuring how many calories we need to feed this patient. To some extent, the elevation of the metabolic rate above basal levels correlates correlates with the cause or severity of the initial injury. For example, if somebody comes in with a broken arm, their metabolic needs aren't going to be as high as somebody who's come in with burns. Here's another, this is our handheld device that we use, the MedGym, and this is actually a really easy, I've done this before, it's 5 minutes, you've put it on. The patient is not supposed to have done any exercise or eaten before utilizing this to get the most accurate reading. Okay, so what about protein? We've done calories. That was our, you know, our first slide. This slide is protein requirements, and there is an elevation in protein requirements. Like we saw earlier with the way that the different patients utilize their nutrients, we have to provide more protein, not only for the healing of the insult, but also to help compensate the increased need for all of the regulatory processes that are in place. The RDA is 0.8 grams per kilogram per day, so that's what most of us, uninjured, you know, healthy beings would require. And a lot of times, you know, even with our patients who we have in ICU that are on SLED, we go up to 2.5 grams per kilogram per day of protein. The lipid requirement, 10 to 30% of total calories, and I have it broken down into two different, I wanted just to bring up these two different types of fats. Medium-chain triglycerides, MCTs, you see these a lot with patients who have leaks, you know, with their lymphatic system. We'll use that as an energy source. The reason why is because MCTs are directly absorbed into the portal system. They don't require going through the liver, and they don't go through the lymphatic system in order to be utilized by the body for energy. The thing is, MCTs are just that. They're a good energy source, but they do not provide essential fatty acids. So we can see a lot of the enteral products that are out there, so much MCT, so much, you know, canola oil or whatever is their fat source. The reason why is because if a patient is compromised, a lot of times their absorption, whether they've had surgery or something like that, they aren't able to absorb as easily. And so that still gives them the calories, and it gives them a good energy source to not overdo them too much on our glucose, you know, because our blood sugars are an issue in the ICU. We don't want all the calories coming from the dextrose, and then we can't overdo protein. So we need to give calories some other way. So MCT is a good way to do that. EPA and DHA, they are the metabolic products of omega-3 fatty acid metabolism. And the reason why this is so important is this is one of the things we're going to talk about with immunonutrition and how effective it can be in the cascade for halting the inflammatory response. Vitamin mineral trace elements, these are things that we're going to add. They're already in enteral products, but with our TPN, we have to add them and adjust them accordingly. And underfeeding in critical patients. This is something that is, there's a lot of information out there about this. You may hear about, you know, we don't want to overfeed patients. A lot of times it can cause more distress because it's causing, if someone's on the ventilator, for example, it's going to cause more work for them to do a higher carbohydrate load, higher calories. And do they really need that? What's the minimum we can really give them to help address their issues without them wasting away, but then not hurt them by overfeeding them too much? Some information I was reading recently, I found, you know, one thing that I thought was really interesting, that they were saying the immune-enhancing diet should be pretty much providing about 50 to 60% of the patient's calculated needs. And that's a goal. We're only looking at meeting half of their needs. We don't even have to meet all their needs. So meeting half their needs can be effective enough to really help some of these cascades from going into motion. So impacts, how are we going to feed them? What we've done now is we've assessed their needs. Now, are we going to feed them PO? Are we going to feed them enterally? Or are we going to feed them parenterally? So going through this, things that can impair intake, things that would make it difficult to feed somebody by mouth if they have a swallowing problem. Obviously, you can consult speech-language pathologists and have them come do a safe swallowing study on them if that's an option. Any type of obstructions, a lot of our cancer patients, our head and necks, have very significant obstructions and aren't able to eat by mouth. If they're intubated or on BiPAP. And the reason why BiPAP is an issue for enterally fed patients is because it requires that tight seal, and it's hard to have that tube fit and keep that seal real tight. Maldigestion, malabsorption, any disease process, a surgical resection. I deal with a GI patient, so I have a lot of pancreatic cancer patients, and a lot of times there's an absorption issue with that. Altered metabolism, they're all hypermetabolic most of the time with an injured patient, a surgical patient. And we also have to think of nutrient losses, drains, ostomies, and fistulas. I deal a lot with patients with ostomies, ileostomies, colostomies, urostomies, you know, all of those. Fistulas, I don't see so much. A lot of those are on the head and neck if they, you know, like I said, if they nick something in surgery, but those are things to consider. We do see intercutaneous occasionally, but this is Aspen's algorithm for helping determine what's the best way to feed a patient. I'm showing this to y'all. This is something that kind of myself as a dietitian goes through my head each time I see a patient, but it helps to break it down. And, you know, functional GI tract, yes, we're going to do enteral nutrition, but there are some other things to consider. You know, no parenteral nutrition is going to be short-term, long-term. You know, how much are we going to look at needing the patient to receive either one of these modalities? So this is just a good kind of reference to have as far as understanding our rationale a lot of times for providing or not providing. Okay, so we've already assessed the patient. We know what's going on. We know how we're going to feed them, whether it's parenterally or enterally. So where does the immunonutrition come in, and what is it? Well, immunonutrition are nutrients given in a supernormal amount to achieve a pharmacological effect on one or more components in the response to surgery, trauma, or infection. What we're trying to do is interrupt an inflammatory process. Giving them these immunonutrients isn't going to make them Superman. What we're trying to do is bring them back up to baseline on how a normal immune system would work. And so that's something just to kind of take in. If we can provide it early in the acute phase response, it is proven to be the most effective. And, you know, that makes sense. We're halting a lot of the processes that can result in wasting. So what's in it? Well, special nutrients that have been found to modulate biologic response to injury, inflammation, and infection. What do these include? These are some of the main ones that you may have heard about: arginine, glutamine, and omega-3 fatty acids. So arginine, let's start with arginine. What is arginine? Well, it's not an essential amino acid in everyday life because our body can produce enough of this from the diet that we take in to meet our needs. But whenever a patient is compromised, i.e. not able to eat, they aren't taking in that regular diet, and their body does need some supplement. All of a sudden, it becomes very essential because arginine is involved in a lot of different processes. For example, the urea cycle, synthesis of other amino acids, polyamines, urea, and nitric acid. Polyamines are important because they serve as mediators of lymphocyte mitogenesis and macrophage-mediated tumor cell cytotoxicity. They also play a key role in regulating the cell cycle and DNA synthesis and participate in the formation of muscle. The urea cycle, obviously, is going to be eliminating the byproduct of protein metabolism, which is ammonia, and detoxifying the system. Okay, this is where it's promoting T cell development and growth and thymatic integrity. That's where it's also part of the immune response. And deficiency would then, of course, lead to poor immune response. If it's not there to do these jobs, then, you know, we're going to have, something's going to be compromised. Okay, and exogenous sources are important during sepsis. The reason why I have this up here is because arginine is a funny bird. It can go one way or the other. This is where understanding your patient is very important. If you have a septic patient, arginine can be life-threatening for this patient because it's involved in the process of producing nitric oxide. And with that, you can have vasodilation. I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. I'm going to go ahead and get to the next slide because that's where we start talking about how it's breaking down into 2 points. So if you have a septic patient, you know, a lot of times, and if you're learning and these, you know, sales reps come in and they tell you, okay, we have this great product for your ICU patients, and if they're compromised, this is what they really need. Well, you know, kind of, yeah, not really, but you really have to know what you're giving them. If it's a trauma patient, then it's a different story, but understanding what's really happening, and if the patient becomes septic, then obviously knowing to discontinue or change the formula. Ornithine is not found in protein. It's formed by hydrolyzing arginine in an important formation of the urea cycle. But the bottom line is, after trauma or surgery, a deficiency in arginine can develop, resulting in arginine becoming conditionally essential amino acid. Arginine can alleviate post-traumatic immune response depression by reducing lymphatic function, and supplying arginine early in the pro-inflammatory phase can assist with restoring the immune system to its normal level. The biggest thing I want y'all to walk away with arginine is that it's only semi-essential, and that knowing what kind of patient to give it to is really important. So there are a lot of formulas that are addressing this. They have some formulas with added arginine and without. They know, you know, when to use it. It's just making sure that whenever they're given the formula, that you know that it's appropriate. Glutamine, another important element with immunonutrition. Our body actually synthesizes enough glutamine under standard conditions. Glutamine and alanine compromise about 6 to 8% of our structural muscle protein, but constitute 70% of the amino acids released by skeletal muscle during stress and sepsis. So it becomes very important whenever you have stress or the patient's been injured. Glutamine freely leaves the muscle or tissue and travels principally to our major organs, liver, kidney, intestine, and pancreas. Glutamine is used as an energy source by the enterocyte, and I'm going to go to my next point here. In fact, the GI tract is thought to be the principal organ of glutamine utilization, and what's important about this is that a lot of these nutrients are really better if they go through your GI tract. You know, we've talked about IV supplementation of these, and I'll go into that in a little bit as far as how its relationship with parenteral nutrition ties together. But glutamine is an important energy building block. It develops short-chain fatty acids, which is utilized for our body as an energy source. It also helps with healthy gut flora, and that becomes important with patients who are on antibiotics for long periods of time. A lot of times you'll have patients receive lactobacillus or something like that. And the bottom line is, though, with glutamine, is it's the most utilized amino acid. So we're eating it up. Our body's eating it up very quickly, and it can be depleted very quickly. Making sure that it's provided as nutrition immune-enhancing additive in hopes of reducing lean muscle mass. We want to stop that muscle from having to give up the glutamine, and we want to provide it so that their muscle mass is as preserved as possible. So omega-3s, this is kind of one that you may have heard the most about because it's all over the place. Omega-3s, well, they're in fish oils. We also have them in other fats, and I have a chart a couple of slides down that will go through that for as far as other sources. But omegas are classified by the presence or two, excuse me, omegas are classified by where they are from the carbon on their chain. And omega-3s are not something that our body creates from fat. So we have to provide it in the diet. Now, it can come in, as an omega-3, and then our body transitions it over to EPA and DHA, but we actually have to provide this type of fat in our diet. EPA and DHA are the metabolic byproducts of omega-3, like I said earlier. they're converted, and this is the important part that I want y'all to get away with, from an 18-carbon omega-3 to a 20-carbon EPA and 22-carbon DHA. It's possible to do this in humans under unstressful conditions. And this is where it's important whenever you see products saying contains EPA and DHA, and they actually have them in that form. Because whenever a patient's in a stressful condition, their body won't switch it over to EPA and DHA, and it's actually the EPA and DHA form that are the beneficial parts of the omega-3s that we want the patient to receive. So if we just gave them plain fish oil and, you know, wasn't broken down, then it wouldn't do them the justice that we want it to. So what do omega-3s do? Well, they do a lot, actually. They decrease the inflammatory response. They decrease cardiac arrhythmias, increase tissue microperfusion, increase graft function, and limits omega-6 immune suppression. Now, when I worked at UTMB in Galveston, I covered the burn unit down there, and one of the physicians, Dr. Herndon, did a lot of research on burn patients and the inflammatory effects of fat. Omega-6, it used to be either you believe in it or you don't, but nowadays we're really seeing that omega-6s do cause a pro-inflammatory response, and that the omega-3s actually compete for the same sites that the omega-6s are going for that push that cascade forward. So what we're doing by providing more of the EPA and DHA is cutting that process off so that the omega-6s, because we have usually a combination when we have our lipid emulsions, it's not just omega-3s, we have a combination of our fat, and so omega-6s are going to be there, but the more omega-3 we can give, the better off we're going to be as far as competing for those response. One way is that they do decrease, omega-3s do decrease the inflammatory response. They do compete for the omega-6 substrate available, resulting in a decreased production of inflammatory prostaglandins, PGE2. Also, EPA exhibits the release of arachidonic acid, which is part of the feedback inhibition mechanism. And you may have heard that a lot with patients. You know, arachidonic acid is what's the cascade is with the omega-6s. That's the mean, you know, product that's going to cause this inflammatory response. So where do we find it? Well, you know, kind of look at our rosemary. Olive oil is a healthy oil, right? You know, what's going on? Where's the omega-3s? Well, it's the type of fat it is. There are saturated fats and unsaturated fats. And so that's why olive oil is healthy, is because it's not a saturated fat, not because it's high in omega-3. But if you look at flaxseed oil, us unstressed, uninjured, is a great source of omega-3s. The thing is now, if we take flaxseed in, our body will convert it over to EPA and DHA. But a question was brought up, you know, why can't we just use flaxseed oil in some of these products? Well, because the body won't transition it over. That's why we have to have it in those two forms. So even though it's there, our body won't utilize it in the way that we really want it to. Okay. So the research on this must be provided into the diet. This is what I want y'all to really walk away with this lecture understanding. Reduces the responsiveness to cytokines and the systemic inflammatory response. It's taking the place of where the inflammatory response would normally happen, and it's cutting it off so we don't have a lot of those cascades come into effect. By down-regulating PGE2 production, the prostaglandins, suppression of the activation of genes involved in the inflammatory process, and themselves are just less inflammatory than the omega-6s. So it's a better source to get to provide patients. So where are we going to find this? Well, unfortunately, mainly in our enteral products. And this is something I thought was important because there's a lot of research being done for patients who are receiving TPN. And out over in Europe, they do have the omega-3s available in the IV form. Here we don't. But, you know, we have these formulas that you see a lot of times, like I said, with reps coming through, and I'm going to give you a list of a few of them here. There's also modulars, and modulars are like the powdered stuff that you always have to flush through the J-tube or the G-tube, you know, so many times a day to kind of give them. So what are we looking at? These are just a few. And Novartis has impact with glutamine, impact 1.5, impact with, you know, everything that you can imagine, combination to meet whatever patient population you're trying to address they have. But the main product is the impact. Their modulars are resource arginate, resource glutazolve, and powder. So you have the glutamine and the arginine there that if a patient for some reason doesn't tolerate an enteral formula, then you can supplement with this, or a more specialized formula, excuse me. Nestle Peptamen AF is a product that is a semi-elemental high protein. It's high in omega-3s. Crucial is one that's popular. Y'all may have heard of that at your institution. It's a semi-elemental. It has arginine and omega-3 in it. Ross has Pivot 1.5, Paratib, and Optimental. And Pivot actually has omega-3s, arginine, and glutamine at an elevated amount. Paratib is a high protein with just arginine in it. And Juven is a powder. You see it a lot of times. It's not for your critically ill patient. This is like a recovery product. Juven is good for wound healing. We do it, I've seen it actually used with some of the head and neck patients at MD Anderson, where, you know, we're still kind of playing around with it to see how effective it is with wound healing, but it's got both arginine and glutamine in it. So what's in parenteral nutrition? Okay, we know it's in enteral nutrition, but how are we giving this parenterally? Well, dextrose, amino acids, lipids, electrolyte, and mineral, vitamins and minerals, that's what's in parenteral nutrition. Unfortunately, we don't have the arginine, the glutamine, or the omega-3 fatty acids available for the IV form yet. There is a lot of research, like I said, being done with arginine and glutamine. And whenever they are doing these studies, they're compounding these products themselves. And a lot of times they're on animal models. The research that's being done with most of these immune-enhancing nutrients are with enteral products. The big controversy with that is most of these, like I was just reading off earlier, omega-3s and arginine, they're combination products with more than one element added to them. So what's really helping and what's the right amount? We're still really in early phases of being able to give exact amounts and exact nutrients, like, okay, which patient would really benefit from some of this. Actually, with the glutamine, it's difficult to provide IV because it's not very soluble, and there are some compounding issues with arginine. The omega-3s, like I said, it's just available in Europe right now. We haven't got it over here yet. I'm not sure the time frame for that, but they are seeing some really good benefit. Okay, we're on our last slide here. Role of the infusion therapy nurse. Well, when I worked, where I've worked before, the infusion therapy nurse always rounded with us and was there to place lines, help determine which type of line is appropriate, monitoring the integrity of the line, flushing the line, monitoring the line placement, making sure if it's migrated, and monitoring for the infection at the site. And I've always kind of been accustomed to having all of us work together, the pharmacist, the dietitian, the infusion therapy nurse, and the physician. So I know a lot of institutions don't necessarily have the luxury to have a full team of people rounding together, but I've had the opportunity and the benefit of seeing how all of us working together is so beneficial, and everyone has an important role, definitely, with nutrition support. Okay, well, that's the end of my talk. Does anybody have any questions?
Thank you for presenting. You alluded to the starvation patient and TPN needs of being 50 to 60% mm-hmm. of goal needs.
Yes, ma'am.
How fast do you present that rate to that goal rate of reflecting that 50 to 60%?
That's a good question. What we do in our institution is we try to initiate, for example, enteral nutrition, and I'm just going to use that as an example, within 24 to 48 hours post-operatively. A lot of ours are surgical patients. We don't see a lot of trauma patients. What we do is we start at 20 cc's, and then we increase every 6 to 8 hours by 20 cc's as tolerated. Obviously, a lot of it's dependent on how well they're going to tolerate the formula. We do We do monitor gastric residual, but we all know that whenever you're sick, your stomach doesn't empty as fast. So if they can have a J-tube replace that Dobhoff further past, you know, post-pyloric, it's much more beneficial as far as the tolerance goes. That's been our biggest issue usually is if it's a gastrically placed tube. I mean, excuse me, the tip is in the stomach. But it's slowly incrementing up as, you know, every 6 to 8 hours.
What about the regular TPN? The patient is already cachectic enough that mm-hmm. they can't tolerate an enteral. They're moving to the parenteral. Mm-hmm. And again, how fast do you present that because yes. of the refeeding mm-hmm. may be delayed?
Absolutely, and that's a good point. What we do is we have three types of formulas at Anderson. We have a high protein, we have a standard, and then we have one that we make up on our own. Somebody who is, and we know, say, for example, they haven't eaten in the past 2 weeks, so we know they're going to go through it. We're going to give them, I mean, we're going to feed them more protein and less dextrose, hold off on the fat till we get a triglyceride level, but slowly increase. A lot of it just depends on what their labs look like, but what we'll do is we'll match the IV fluids, whatever they're getting dextrose in the IV fluids or K, and we'll match that in the TPN because we know they're at that level. We'll start initiating the protein additive in the TPN, and then the next day, we'll see a shift, usually with the potassium, the FOS, the MAG. We'll see a shift with the increased utilization of the nutrients. So it can take good 3 days for really us to get up to goal rate with the TPN, just depending on their response to it. I've had a lady before, though, that hadn't eaten in 3 weeks, and it took us like 5 days to get up to her goal rate because we kept having to, you know, give her runs of KFOS and MAG. I mean, you know, it just depends. But a lot of times, I would say at least 2 to 3 days for the most of the time, you know, for a patient who's been starved or who's going to be going through refeeding syndrome. And they may not get exactly 50% until that time, but they're getting something, and something's better than nothing.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi. At our facility, they're very hesitant to order TPN mm-hmm. for anybody. And so they take this functional gut and they expand it out to include just about everybody. So there was a case recently where somebody came in. They had been nauseated and vomiting for maybe a week before admission. And then they discovered the problem. They were in the hospital 2 or 3 days, then took them to surgery for a gut surgery. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about 3 weeks with no nutrition, and regardless of that, afterwards the nutritionist said they had a functional gut because there was no obstruction.
Yeah.
And so they recommended enteral feeding as opposed to TPN. Mm-hmm. What is your definition of a functional gut?
Well, a functional gut is where there's no obstruction, there's no malabsorption issue, but the functionality of the gut is relative. Do they have a lot of atrophy? Patients who haven't been fed over a period of time, those villi really do shrink down, and they don't have the absorption that they would before. That's what happens when you don't feed those villi. And so what you have is a lot of diarrhea and malabsorption that goes on. And so what we have patients that are in that same situation. A lot of times what we'll do is we'll start TPN, and we'll start enteral feedings, and then as we'll start them with like a basic product, you know, and watch and see how they tolerate it. Ideally, we don't want to start somebody on TPN if it's not going to be at least for 7 days because of the risks and everything they go through to have the line placed. If there's a line there and the situation's not such a big deal, then yeah, a lot of times we'll do that. But I can appreciate what you're saying because it's a fine line. It's like, okay, we need to give something to them and, you know, something has happened. So I've seen it where we've really kind of started both, and then just as one's titrated up, we've just decreased the other one.
It's a good idea.
Yeah.
One more question. Mm-hmm. This has to do with Dobhoff placement.
Sure.
And I know you can put a Dobhoff wherever you want. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no, like, you have to put it here or there or whatever. Mm-hmm. However, we have a real high aspiration risk at our hospital. I mean, our numbers are just astronomical for aspiration-related deaths. And usually the nutritionist will recommend that it be placed below the pylorus. Mm-hmm. Is that your recommendation?
Absolutely, and that's Aspen's recommendation as well. You have a lower incidence. If actually what we try and do is get it past the ligaments or trites, usually just as far down as we can, and a lot of ours are placed in surgery. It's harder to do. I mean, we can do it fluoroscopically, but for the most part, that's our recommendation because there is a huge, there's a significant difference. Because like we said earlier, when you're sick, your stomach doesn't empty. I mean, it's not even have to be from a trauma, from a surgery or an insult. It just stops functioning, and that's just physiologically what happens.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just had a quick question about residual amounts.
Okay.
We still have nurses that hold for very small residual amounts. What types of parameters are you seeing?
Well, you know, I've seen it from anywhere from 200 to 400. Mm-hmm. And we've actually just, we're working on right now doing, we're doing some research on changing and, you know, because some nurses are like, hey, two times the rate, 100, 120, what's the safe thing? Well, to be honest, you know, our stomach already produces, I believe it's like 50 cc's of gastric secretions per hour. So we're already, I mean, it's not even the feeding, it's just the part. And then with that alone, without it emptying at a regular rate, you're going to have some residual. I say that, you know, we're looking closely at it and we're seeing above 200. And I think what we're going to say is 200 is what we're going to feel comfortable with. What they can do is take it again. What we have them do is replace the feeding. If it's less than 200 or less, they replace what they've taken out. And then in an hour later, we can check it again. If they're really concerned, the nurse feels they're symptomatic. A lot of times what you're really looking for is symptoms. If there's a change in the respiratory, if they're showing signs of anything, if they have, you know, any change in the patient's status that would indicate something's going on, that's really what you're looking for. It's a symptom. And if you don't see symptoms, patients tolerating, you're thinking, hey, bowel's functioning, then it's probably fine. But if you can get that to past that point is really kind of the way to try and go. But 200.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Well, thanks y'all so much for coming.